We are living in a politically divided pandemic. We look to our leaders hoping for some understanding beyond politics, understanding of the complexity of everyone's lives. But for many of us, there is someone who understands, who gives us some hope. But sadly, she's not running for president. She's been described by Sarah Smarch as the most powerful, least political feminist in the world. That person is Dolly Parton. There's a new book out by award-winning writer Sarah Smarch. In her writing and her journalism, she explores class and rural people. We talked to her for Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. And her new book is out just in time to give us some hope. It's called She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. Sarah, welcome back to KEXE, KBXE. Thanks for being here.
Heidi, thanks for having me back. My chat with you a couple years ago was one of my favorites out of many I was fortunate to do. So I've been looking forward to chatting with you.
Yeah. Well, okay. So the phrase, she come by it natural. In some ways, when you look at Dolly, at the theatrics of Dolly Parton, natural isn't always the word we would use to describe her. So how does it describe Dolly in your mind?
Well, this paradox is really at the heart of the Dolly mystery and magic, which is that she very famously presents herself in ways that we might describe as artificial, whether that involves makeup or wigs or plastic surgery and so on. But yet she, within that container or package is a person who couldn't be more real and authentic. The title actually, though, comes from a phrase that my grandma uses. She's a contemporary of Dolly's. They were born just a few months apart. We were kind of talking about, you know, how did Dolly end up with this sort of persona that involves a lot of humor and bravado and just the character of Dolly that we all know and love. And my grandma made the comment, she come by it natural. And that is her explanation for, you know, anyone's life outcomes that result from their origin story. So that was her way of saying Dolly is of her place and people. And that's why she speaks very specifically in some particular ways to rural women.
That's what I like about this book. It is certainly an exploration of Dolly, but it is about rural women. It's about you. And I'm assuming you're talking about your grandma, Betty.
Yeah, this, you know, I'm certainly not a celebrity writer, and the book is by no means a biography. It actually began as a magazine series that I wrote a few years ago for a country music publication. But, you know, just looking at how Dolly kind of exemplifies a certain brand of working class feminism, as I call it, and that has really not been explored in any kind of academic or formal way. Because women like Dolly and my grandma were kind of left out of a lot of those discussions. They weren't in college classrooms, and they're not in activist circles that tend to correlate with college campuses and particular professions. So, you know, my goal was for Dolly to be kind of the lens through which we look at the intersections of class and gender in this country. That said, I think that Dolly fans will find, you know, everything they would hope to find in there about her life and career. But there's a bunch of other stuff woven in too.
Well, so Dolly left home early because she wanted to be a country music star, and country music, the entertainment industry, now it is still dominated by men. Women don't get played on the radio as much, and women don't have the kind of power that men do in those kinds of industries. How did she get in there? How did she keep her own goals at the forefront and not fall prey to people like her boss, Porter Wagner? How did that happen for her?
Well, it was the 1960s when she got on a bus, you know, from rural East Tennessee to head to Nashville with her guitar and her few belongings in her hand. And it wasn't an overnight success story. You know, she paid her dues, as they say. She would take just kind of little mercenary gigs that were kind of beneath her, but she needed to try to put food on the table. Sometimes she couldn't even afford to do that. And she has talked about those early years in Nashville involving literal hunger. She would kind of haunt hotel hallways waiting for someone to put their room service tray outside of their room. And if there was any good food left on it, that would be her dinner. So after a few years of those struggles, she had some breakthroughs. She's a very prolific writer and actually identifies as a songwriter even before singer and performer. And some of those songs she wrote were getting attention, getting cut by successful artists. She herself had a couple of, you know, relatively minor hits as a singer and performer. She catches the eye of Porter Wagoner, who has this hugely popular television show, and he's an immense figure in the world of country music. And he wants her to come on as his little girl singer, as he would have said, and essentially to just be kind of the pretty lady next to him singing duets. Well, he got a lot more than he bargained for because she was a better singer, a better songwriter, and a better performer than he was. And pretty soon her star kind of eclipsed his. How did she stay true to herself along the way? There are a lot of stories in the book about moments when specifically powerful men were giving her bad advice, telling her what to do. This would have been, of course, things like that still happen today. Sexism is by no means cured in culture, but in the 1960s, it was even more harrowing for a woman in a very male space to be attempting to carve out her own career with her own integrity in mind rather than just being of service to other people's goals. So she very famously, for instance, said no to Elvis Presley relatively early in her career when he wanted to record one of her songs, but only if she would give him half the publishing rights. And she had made a promise to herself she would always keep the publishing on her own writing. That song was I Will Always Love You, and the long game decision proved very profitable when Whitney Houston recorded the song in 1992, and Dolly Parton has since said, that single made me so rich I could buy Graceland.
That's Sarah Smarch. We're talking about her new book. It's called She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. I suspect the songwriting part of Dolly is what really hits home for you. She's taken women's stories, but she tells them differently than the stories we've heard within the norms of country music. But we don't really realize it because we're used to Dolly. Can you talk a little bit about her songwriting, how it has kind of changed over the years too?
Sure. So for kind of the lay Dolly Parton fan or someone that's just kind of familiar with her as a ubiquitous, you know, aspect of culture for decades now, they might know her more for her kind of pop country presence. And actually where she began with her songwriting was very dark, haunting Appalachian melodies and stories that usually are about young women, as like herself when she was writing those songs, who were up against all the challenges that we might describe in more academic terms as the patriarchy. But it was the stuff of her life as a country girl looking around and seeing that, you know, women were vulnerable to domestic violence. There were no laws on the books protecting them from something like that. Reproductive rights were by no means accessible for women in a pre-Roe v. Wade era. A lot of her songs are about teenage girls getting pregnant by a guy who says he loves them and then runs off. Sometimes those girls get shipped off. They've shamed their family. They get sent off with their baby. Sometimes in these songs, the girl even takes her own life. There's an incredible song from her early work called The Bridge that follows a tale like that. So her early music is really bearing witness to the world that she had just barely, you know what, I hesitate to use the term escape because that same world is also full of beauties and riches that she loves and that she has chosen to give her wealth and presence to in many ways. She's still very much a part of Tennessee and I think identifies with country people more than any other. But by the same token, as a young woman, there were particular dangers in that space that she had just barely escaped. And these songs kind of bear witness to the lives of the women that she saw around her that very easily could have been her and thus changed the trajectory of her life. You know, then she would, of course, soon become a pop country crossover and then just pop music outright, a Hollywood star, and now just a kind of multimedia presence in popular culture. But where it all began was definitely a desire to tell stories that in, you know, the analysis of my book, we might say are about the intersection of gender and class.
Yeah, I'm someone who, Dolly was always around. It made me think about this as I was reading your book about where did I first hear about her? And I was thinking I had an aunt I was very close to and my sister's a lot older and they took me to 9 to 5 when I was a kid. And we pretended like we were each of the characters. I can't remember. I got to call my aunt up and ask her which character we played. But, and I don't, you know, of course I didn't catch that. But, and I also remember my dad loving Dolly Parton on the variety show we would watch. And knowing some of the music, more like the Kenny Rogers era and that kind of stuff. But since, you know, in the last years, I have fallen in love with her music, but also just kind of know her big ones. Jolene, I could hear that all day long. I never get sick of that song.
Mm-hmm.
But the other day on the radio, I played the song, The
Bargain Store.
Yeah. Holy.
The Bargain Store. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's my favorite.
That might be my new favorite. Can you talk a little bit about that song? Something like that. I mean, the writing of that is amazing.
My life is likened to a bargain store. I may have just what you're looking for. If you don't mind the fact that all the merchandise is used, but with a little mending it could be as good as new. Why, you take for instance this old broken heart. If you will just replace the missing parts, you would
this
be surprised
is one of to my mind, the songs that most exemplify Dolly's message and what she represents and the commitment that she has held on to throughout her life to sort of be an ambassador, I suppose, to the rest of the world for poor or economically disadvantaged women. The song The Bargain Store is sung in the voice of a woman who is saying to a would-be lover or romantic partner, my body and my heart and soul, they're like something in a bargain store. They're not new. They're somewhat used. This being kind of like metaphorical language to say, I'm not a virgin, my heart's been broken before, and so on. And yet I am good. And if you trust in that, you'll find that I still have a lot to offer. And the brilliance of that metaphor is that as someone who grew up very rarely possessing something that wasn't secondhand and feeling an almost, even to this day, even though, I could afford to buy something new, I get more satisfaction for a lot of reasons by finding something at a yard sale or an estate sale or a thrift shop. So Dolly's making this very clever gender commentary there that is to say we're living in the midst of this culture that, and this was far more true when she was young, that sort of creates this very dangerous false dichotomy about women where you have the virgin and the whore, if you will. And she's very delicately saying, and never in overt terms, but suggesting, I'm neither one of those things. I'm complicated and good. And she does it through conveying the symbol of the bargain store that is touchstone of the poor American experience. So, and it's all in this incredible melody that, you know, if you like Jolene, you'll love the bargain store because it's that same kind of minor, almost dark, complicated melody.
Right, in the rhythm of it. Oh my gosh. It's kind of like when you read about the rhythm that she came to with the pop song 9 to 5 of her fingernails, figuring it out on this on the set and hearing that typewriter. I mean, gosh, she just knows how to get at the normal, everyday stuff that women deal with.
I've wasted love, but I still have some more. The bargain store is open, come inside. You can easily afford the price.
I want to go back a little bit about the women who have lived her songs. You write about a really interesting idea of leaving. You say a woman's departure is a declaration. Can you explain that a little bit?
So around, well, let's see, not long before I was doing the writing for this book, which originated as a magazine serial that I started working on in 2016, not long before that, a fairly famous 21st century feminist book came out called Lean In, and the philosophy written by one of the now executives of Facebook, a woman of immense racial and wealth privilege, was suggesting, here's how to get ahead in business, ladies. You lean into the XYZ, and ultimately the objective is to get as much pay as the men in the office and get more equal share of household duties with your professional husband and so on. And, you know, there are some real class blind spots in that book, and something I had been thinking about in my relationship to feminism or the assertion of your own value as a woman is that more often for someone who does not have the kind of cultural or social capital that someone like the author of that book has, more often her best bet, if she wants to not just necessarily even thrive, but just survive, is to leave. And there were many models for that when I was growing up. My grandmother, Betty, who I've already mentioned, was actually married many times. And that was because she just over and over kept getting dealt a pretty bad hand in terms of her male partners. Sometimes that involved abuse. And she would, though she had very little to her name to do so in terms of economic resources, if she just had enough money to put gas in the tank of her car, then she left. And there are parallels of that in the workforce. You know, if you are a woman who you're low on the socioeconomic ladder, as I was starting out, sometimes I was working jobs where I was harassed, sexually harassed, and the lean in philosophy would suggest sue them, change the environment, you know, work on making demands in that space. And those sorts of ideas are preposterous for, you know, like a 20-year-old waitress. In those cases, I quit those jobs, and sometimes I didn't have money for groceries for a while because of my own impulse for self-preservation. So Dolly Parton left the Porter Wagoner show against his wishes once her contract obligations were over. And that departure, just like her leaving her hometown in Sevier County, Tennessee, where people laughed when she said she was going to be a star, there have been moments in her life, and I would bet that there's moments in just about every woman's life where if they ended up reaching their own potential and self-fulfillment, it was because they walked away from untenable situations that would have rather sapped their energy for someone else's purposes.
There's so much I would love to talk about, but I want to make sure we get to this, what Dolly is right now. There was just a New Yorker article that you posted that really gets at this idea of, like, why does Dolly speak to all of us? Why does it transcend race and gender and sexuality and economic status? Why is she the great unifier?
Well, I think that, you know, we can't really have a thorough discussion about Dolly without mentioning the fact that she's a quite, I wouldn't necessarily say religious person in a, you know, the sense of dogma and organized religion, but she does identify as a Christian and is deeply what we might call spiritual. And she lives and breathes and exemplifies the highest virtues and values of Christ message, which was non-judgment and love regardless of, and even in a moment of feeling anger or having some right to be angry, as she has no doubt many times over the course of her career, she has maintained a smile, a gratitude, and a peaceful presence that also, in terms of her fandom, translates to just a broad acceptance and celebration of all different kinds people. And, you know, very early in her career, she established quickly a large LGBTQ following, for example. And it had a lot to do, I think, with her, you know, even as a cisgender heterosexual woman, empathizing to some extent with people whose gender and sexuality were somehow marginalized or scrutinized by society. You know, she is a woman who has for many years essentially been putting on this immense gender performance in a very calculated way. And so I think that she understood in some way a little bit about their world and appreciated and loved it. She made the comment, if I'd been born a man, I would have been a drag queen. So like, she's, even though she's seemingly of a place that we often correlate with conservative politics, she's always just exemplified love, and her fans feel that and understand it, and they go along for the ride with her.
You had the chance to go to a concert and bring your grandma. What was that like? What was the crowd like?
Oh, wow. So this was in 2016 during this big arena tour she did for an album called Pure and Simple. And I'd never been to a show with my grandma growing up. I only ever even went to one concert. You know, we didn't have money for things like concert tickets. And so, I don't know, around 1986, my dad took me to see Reba McEntire at the State Fair. We're not a family that's like going out to cultural events together because cultural events cost money. But in 2016, I could afford a couple of tickets to this tour, and I took my grandma Betty. Gosh, the crowd, that was the first time I had ever seen Dolly live. And the crowd just blew me away in its diversity, you know, different races and one would presume politics on display and across every line of identity, whether to do with gender, sexuality, religion, ethnicity. They all knew the words to all her songs and they all sang along and not just connecting with her, but in a way connecting with each other in a way that I found very moving in 2016, which was a very divisive year in politics. I remember some drag queens turning around and kind of like leading the audience in like this swaying dance to some song she was singing. And then you've got like the guy with muddy boots and a t-shirt that says Proud Redneck, and he's like swaying with them. It was quite transcendent, quite magical. And she even made the comment on stage in direct reference to the politics of that moment. She said, wouldn't it be nice if we could bottle up a little bit of the energy that we're feeling in here and take it with us when we leave? So I think that's kind of part of her mission.
That's Sarah Smarsh. The new book is She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. Thanks for your time today. It was fun to talk to you.
Heidi, it's always a pleasure. Thanks a bunch.
All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories of where I've been and how I got to where I am. But these stories